Okay, so well, that's a good enough place to start. So welcome, friends. So, of course, we know you, Ziad. You've been our hero podcast content machine of all kinds. But we also have a new member of our illustrious crew here at the East as a podcast, which is to say, somebody new is joining us. Yana, do you want to introduce yourself?
Sure. Well, thanks for inviting me on. Glad to be part of the crew. I'm Yara Shafani, and I am Palestinian and Lebanese. I'm an organizer here in the Toronto area, currently organizing with the Palestinian Youth Movement's Toronto chapter.
Ziad.
So my name is Ziad Nabulsi. I'm of Palestinian and Egyptian descent. I'm a PhD student. Yeah, I work on intellectual history of anti-colonial movements in general.
I guess I'm calling it right now in my head like an informal series, but kind of thinking around the title of like 100 years of Palestinian resistance. I'm not a guy who has goals for things, but if there is like a goal for this, which is take us some issues of Palestinian history, of regional history, through the lens specifically of Palestinian resistance to colonization. So what does that mean? I think there is this thing of thinking through the Nakba as this like cleavage event, so the before and after the Nakba, and that's typically a way of sort of like thinking about the history of Palestine, which is like the loss of it. But I think in some ways, the goal of this is to kind of think more, what is it, synchronically, I think? Is that the term I'm looking for? I can't remember. Diachronically? I don't remember. I always mix them up. Di means two, so it means many. So diachronically, which is to say, like, think about like a lot of the history that we don't talk about that's kind of precluded or like eluded from the debate or whatever of like, you know, characters, histories, specific stories, things that are known as riots, whatever, like these kind of spotty histories, at least for me, and I'm an outsider, like both of you are Palestinian, obviously. So there's obviously like a personal dimension that I lack in all of this. So to me, you know, a lot of it comes through the text, comes through like historical text or whatever, or listening to other people. So it's not something familial, but as a result, you end up looking at things the way that, you know, dominant historiography makes you want to look at it. And the result partially is this business of Israel's founding or the Nakba, which is the word from the Palestinian perspective, which is like what you always say. But even then, that by situating that date, that specific thing, you're really just kind of like, not just, I don't want to say erasing, but you are funneling a lot of complicated sort of very interesting and very like instructive histories into simply this thing of what happened when Israel happened. So it's like this earthquake, which is like before and after. So that's kind of like the goal of this series, I think. And we're starting with a name, a figure whose name is oft mentioned, but whose actual sort of like, you know, power or legacy is not really discussed. So I don't know how we want to start this with the biographical. Who are we talking about?
Yeah, so we're talking today about Izz ed-Din al-Qassam. So maybe to give, maybe I'll give a kind of brief overview. So he's born in 1882, which is also a significant year, you know, to put it in the kind of wider context of colonialism and the Arabic-speaking world. 1882 is the year where Ahmad Arabi's revolt is also defeated in Egypt. So it's this moment of defeat. And, you know, he's the son of a local religious figure. And his family very much expected him to continue working, playing this role. And so he had the kind of education that students of his father would have had. So, you know, he started out in a kutab, he learned to read and write through reading the Quran. You learn, you know, Arabic grammar, all of this stuff. But also at that time, so late 19th century, there were attempts to sort of modernize education in the Arabic-speaking world, you know, in the Levant and in general in the Arabic-speaking parts of the Ottoman Empire. So there were these attempts to introduce modern sciences, or in Arabic, you know, the designation for it was the distinction between al-ulum al-naqliyya, so what you just study through perhaps rote learning, and al-ulum al-aqliyya, so like rational sciences. So he would have had exposure to that. And then he goes to Cairo to study at Al-Azhar at around the late 19th century, turn of the 20th century. And again, Al-Azhar at that time is sort of brimming with reformist thought. And we'll get, you know, I think we'll discuss what reformism meant in that context. But generally, in intellectual circles in Cairo and elsewhere, there was discontent with the existing state of affairs. There was this impression that the Arab world and the Islamic world, because those were also Islamic thinkers, was in a state of weakness. And then the debate was about, okay, how do we diagnose what's the cause of this weakness? And then he returns to Syria, and maybe I'll hand it over to Yara. Yeah.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, so I think he returns to Syria, and during that time there the First World War breaks out, and he enlists in the Ottoman army to and joins the fight against the French occupation. He runs an insurgency for about a year in northern Latakia. During that time, actually, a lot of his understanding of anti-colonial struggle and also class relations within anti-colonial struggle is formed. So you really see this person who I think is, and I think just to actually backtrack for a second, like during that particular moment in time with the First World War, you had a huge shift in the situation, material situation for the people that were living in Syria. You had large and medium-scale landowners becoming more powerful and mass dispossession and urbanization of peasants. And, you know, during that particular moment when he's leading the insurgency in Latakia against the French, he observes that class is impacting how one is able to commit to the struggle. And that's likely something that then impacts the way that he chooses to organize in Palestine. So after the defeat his particular insurgency, he's sentenced to death in Syria, and he flees to Haifa, to Palestine, through Lebanon. And so he flees from the front, from a place where there's a French mandate to a place where there's a British mandate. Then he essentially is central to Palestinian organizing. So during his time in Haifa, he moves, the area that he lives in is particularly important because Haifa in particular was a centralized place for the British mandate's colonization. And so a port had just been built. And so there were huge waves of Zionist immigration. And the people who were largely rural and peasants, the rural population, is faced with this huge shift with industrialization and mass land sales that were pushing the peasants off the land into a labor market that essentially either underpaid them or just outright didn't employ them. And so his message, which was a message of speaking to this alienated class of people, and it was a message of both anti-colonialism and anti-Zionism. And so he was able to make these connections between the Zionist immigration and the British mandate in ways that others at the time were not able to do. And so he was able to amass, I think, quite a large following of supporters, which eventually became called the Qasimites. And so what you had was this person who was engaged, and I mean, I think it's interesting because he engages in all kinds of different activism. And so he engages with labor activists, is part of Palestinian Arab Workers Society, which he sees as a front for national liberation struggle. He works with certain members of the Palestinian Communist Party at the time. And then he founds, most importantly, the Young Muslim Men's Association, the YMMA. And, you know, this particular association, I think, then becomes a vehicle for him to be able to put together entire resistance cells across Palestine that would play a really central role in the Arab revolts that would follow in 1936. So, you know, I don't want to jump too far ahead into history, but I think that there's a really important piece there, which is that what he teaches us, and this kind of touches back on what you how we opened this conversation. What he teaches us, I think, in so many ways, is that there was this long history of Palestinian struggle before the Nakba, right? And oftentimes that struggle gets entirely erased into like this because the story always begins at the Nakba, which is what you were saying, Sina. And I think I really appreciated that because I think there is, you know, this idea that Palestinians just fled, right? Escaped colonization in 47 during the Nakba with no context to what all of the events that led up to that, right? is false. And I think, you know, reading through this pre-Nakba history really shows us the different ways that Palestinians were organizing at a time when colonization and class formation was shifting really in ways that I think were pivotal. And I think we'll sort of unpack those as we move along today. But it also, you know, reading through this particular piece of history, right? One, like I know when I was began reading Hassan Kanafani's Arab Revolts, which kind of covers this particular moment in time, thinking of all of the ways in which, like looking for my grandfather almost in some of these pages, right? All of our families have some kind of connection to this pre-Nakba struggle.
It makes sense why his name is used today, right? Like he's this guy born in what is modern Syria, educated in Egypt, and kind of lives this itinerant life. We should talk about his work and what that meant of him actually going around and like being. I want to think more about like the fact that this is anti-colonial struggle live, and he's watching colonization happening live. He's watching the arrival of, there's a figure here, I can't remember, but basically in like a short period of time, like 50, a decade and a half, you know, immigration, like Zionist immigration to Palestine goes up something like eightfold or something like that. How's my math? It was like 50,000 and then 350,000. I don't know, something like that. My numbers are bad. But, you know, this guy is watching it there. He's seeing it happen before his eyes. Everybody was watching it happen. And the idea that this is just, they just fled on foot one night in 1948 or whatever, like this is fiction, right? That there was this long history and this long agonizing over like, look what they're doing to our homeland. Like, look what's happening to our homeland. So like that for me is like, it's incredibly painful to think of this. It's actually a lot easier to do the Zionist historiography of like, oh, 1948 happened. They call it the Nakba, boom. Like but to think about like those people watched for 25 years, longer really, their patrimony, I mean, to use a romantic bourgeois term, like was taken from them. So like that, there's a very tragic underlying aspect of all this. They watched it happen in slow-mo at a time where this is also very intimate, right? This is like farmers, peasants, like this is a deeply agrarian society. So not only did colonization arrive in a hurry, like it wasn't some slow thing, but also the industrialization of this land, of this mostly agrarian peasant class, arrived in a total hurry. So processes that took decades and, you know, a century plus in Europe or whatever, of like ripping people out from the land, of privatizing it, whatever, they take place in what looks like, I mean, from this, I mean, you guys are the historians here, but like 3-4 decades, like less, accelerated intensely because you had this active settler colonial project that was highly advanced. And, you know, this is the middle of the 20th century. Like the tools of colonization have increased, like mapping, radio technology, like the ability to do this, something daring like this, you know, obviously being aligned with the imperialist powers, being, you know, I guess in some ways a proxy of the imperialist powers, like that helped the Zionists and was working against what is essentially this peasant population. I mean, I guess I'm asking you to think more globally before we do more biography of.
Yeah, I think one of the stats that always, you know, sticks out with me is by 1935, one-fifth of Palestinians had been rendered landless, right? So, I mean, now we're talking over a decade pre-Nakba. And so to understand that, I think that speaks to the exact processes that you were outlining, right? Which is, and these were the processes that he walked in, like he entered Palestine and witnessed. And he had witnessed those similar processes happening in Syria, right? And his organizing in Syria as well from the very early stages. I mean, he organized and collected funds for an envoy to go to what would be modern day Libya to resist against the Italian invasion. And one of the things that he observed, and this was during a time where the Ottoman Empire had made concessions to the Europeans. And so he was observing the ways in which elements of, you know, what would we would consider almost like an Arab or Muslim bourgeois, like a newly forming, right, petty bourgeois, was actually playing a reactionary role. And I think that this then speaks to a lot of his organizing in Palestine, where the Palestinian traditional leadership is also playing a really reactionary role. And the place that he goes to is significant, right? Like he lives much of his life in the Wadi Salib area, a part of Palestine that I think the colonial infrastructure was almost impossible to ignore. So you had like planned industrial and commercial developments, which were rendering Palestinians landless. You had high crime rates and homelessness. There was even a smallpox outbreak that came out of a drainage system lack of drainage system, I should say. And so essentially what you had was the creation of slums, and Wadi Salib was pinched right between a bay and a really a community of Zionist settlers that was actually becoming extremely wealthy. And you had this kind of dynamic playing all across historic Palestine with the Zionist population organizing really strongly around labor unions at the time, and a labor movement that was, Zionist, ultimately a Zionist movement that was advocating for higher pay and employment for Jewish workers and working really closely with the British Mandate. And you had a traditional kind of Palestinian elite who was trying to emulate that same project, right? And trying to have those same interactions, advocating for working with the British Mandate. You even had elements of the Palestinian elite at the time who thought that the British Mandate was going to potentially be a way for them to amass wealth and power. They welcomed the British Mandate. And I think that that's a dynamic that we see playing out across the globe, right? With the way that colonization historically creates a particular kind of comprador in any place. And that comprador then seeks to speak for the people, the oppressed masses, right? And so it absolutely is, like, I think a really, really important time. And I think the other piece that's important to note is where, like Haifa was one of the places that many Syrian exiles had fled to. And so it was a unique place in a couple of ways, because you had a large number of Syrian exiles there, and that created more of a connection between the Palestinians and this concept of Bilad al-Sham. And then you had, like, as mentioned before, all of these land sales and labor strifes and Zionist migration. And so you had this feeling of, like, collective dispossession. People were feeling like they were being dispossessed by a particular process. And I think that the conditions were there to create and help organize around that class consciousness and anti-colonial struggle that he was able to do. And I think, Ziad, you could probably speak more to that.
Yeah, I mean, just to sort of follow up on what Yara was saying. So, I mean, if you look at it historically, you had sort of by the mid-19th century, right, these transformations in the Ottoman Empire, in the sense that there is a greater integration into the capitalist world system. Peasants in Palestine are getting integrated, but there is also a kind of debt crisis which is happening to this peasantry. So you had, a debt crisis around the mid-19th century. You had, merchants taking advantage of peasants, interest rates of around like 36 to 60%. So I'm getting these figures from Hoda Farou, who's a scholar of the sort of socioeconomic context in that period. The other thing to note is that in Palestine there was also a kind of land question. So you had, like, at around the early 1930s, so 1931, you had 144 families who owned most of the land, and you had 29% of Arab families were landless, and this was as a result of dispossession by sort of the big landowners, but also deliberate British policy during the mandate, which explicitly attempted to favor Jewish settlers' economic expansion at the expense of the economic interests of Arab workers and even the Arab bourgeoisie. So you had sort of during the mandate period, the wages for Arab workers decline actually by 50%. So again, these are Hoda Farou's figures. And 95% of workers were indebted. So you could see there was already this sort of massive crisis brewing, of course. And the other thing to note in connection to this is Al-Qassam's deep interest in picking sort of the adequate historical moment for launching a revolt. So he's studying, looking at these phenomena, of course, trying to understand when this would be adequate to launch. Yeah, and I just found the figures that you and Sina were referring to with respect to sort of the influx of Jewish settlers. So if you look at it, you know, in 1917, Jewish settlers were about 10% of the population, but by 1936, they were 28% of the population. So you see this like massive influx over a five-year period. And this is obviously in the lead up to Al-Qassam's decision to actually launch his revolt. Yeah, and the other thing I wanted to note in terms of context is Al-Qassam is reacting also to a history of failure, which Yara alluded to, right? You discussed, you know, the kind of mode of politics that just relied on petitions, basically. This was what the big landowners wanted to do from, you know, 1917 through 1929. They think, okay, we'll petition and maybe we'll get on good terms with the British mandate government in the same way that the Zionists were able to do. And obviously this failed. So again, there is a kind of history of failure that Al-Qassam is responding to, and that's important for understanding his historical context.
Mick, can we talk a little bit about the nature of his work professionally? Mm-hmm. So his training, the kind of bureaucratic work, but also the teaching. Because there's this great anecdote from where the book reading is Mark Sanagan's book, Lightning Through the Clouds, 2020. University of Texas. And there's this great little anecdote about it. One student remembers Al-Qassam leading the school in commemoration of the triumphs of Saladin over the Crusaders, and in particular, the 1187 Battle of Hattin, which took place to the west of Haifa. The students reenacted the Battle of Hattin with a particular emphasis on the Islamic character of Saladin. The obvious parallels between the Islamic reconquest of Palestine from the Western Christian Crusaders were surely not lost on the students, and Al-Qassam was able to turn the reenactment into an annual affair through his tenure at the school. Later in 1929, the celebration, which Al-Qassam played a leading role in starting, was turned into an explicit nationalist rally. So, like, this is Fanonian chapter on national culture and how using the consciousness of nationalism, like what nationalism can provide. So, like, nationalism has been a tool in our day today. We think of, especially if we listen to like white leftists in New York, they'll say that, oh, nationalism is bad. It's bad. Maybe because they're white. Yes, that's true. But for them, like, they had never considered anti-national, anti-colonial nationalism, right? And so how the idea of being part of a nation, as fictional as it may be, could be used to unite disparate groups of people who had hitherto just been villagers across different landscapes, who didn't need nationalism to unite them in any way, because, you know, the Ottoman Empire, which we probably should talk a little bit about today, with its kind of lax administrative, or I don't know about lax, but in terms of it wasn't a very, I don't know, again, I'm out of my depth here, but it didn't seem as invasive as the British Imperial Mandate period, obviously, not even respect to Zionism, but in terms of how it governed, it's wilayats, I think they were called, yeah. Right?
Yeah, and just very briefly, just as a follow-up, it was actually, you know, precisely in the 19th century where you see the Ottoman Empire trying to modernize through centralization. And trying to sort of, you know, because if you compare any kind of modern state to a pre-modern state, the power of the modern state in terms of its ability to sort of, you know, keep track of what people are reading in schools, you know, where they pray and stuff, it's obviously much greater in comparison to any pre-modern state. You know, it doesn't matter if you're an empire or a small emirate. You know, it's this capacity to have this invasive control just doesn't exist. So the Ottomans are trying also to overcome this through centralizing things like education, centralizing the bureaucracy, making sure that they can sort of keep al-ayan, who are sort of the local prominent figures who were sort of used to as a kind of buffer between the population which was ruled and the Ottoman elite. They were trying to sort of keep them under control as well to some extent. So I mean, there is definitely this element.
The bits about his time as a teacher, right, and also like the ways in which he mobilized and organized. I'm thinking there's in Kanafani's Arab revolts, Kanafani, I guess, interviews a Qassamite, and he says Al-Qassam programmed his revolt in three stages, the first being psychological preparation and the dissemination of revolutionary spirit. The second, the formation of secret groups, committees, and training the committees around security, espionage, and propaganda, etc. And then the final stage being armed revolt, right? And so there was this really calculated process that he had formulated, which started with this psychological preparation, right? And that goes back to his sermons. It goes back to the way that he taught, you know, thinking to, and this comes from Sanagin's book. There's a story that's referenced that from his time as a teacher, where there a lecture kind of devolves into this conversation around the British mandate and Zionist migration to Palestine. And a student asks him how he would solve the issue. And he pulls out a pistol from under his jacket and says, with this, you know. And so there's this clear kind of conviction for this anti-colonial struggle that we can trace throughout his entire legacy from wherever he's going. And there's this commitment to these radical and revolutionary, I mean, sermons, right? So like at some point, even dating back actually to his time in Syria and that resistance to the Italian invasion of modern day Libya, that was through his sermons that he calls on the volunteers to join that struggle. And then we can trace those sermons all the way to his time in Palestine post like in the 30s, where at this point the British are really closely monitoring what he's doing and what he's saying. The British had deemed his sermons as violent. They were worried about the kind of content that he was speaking to, precisely because it was so rooted in anti-colonial discourse. And you know, to that point around nationalism, right? I mean, it's interesting because the movement that he founded, the Young Men's Muslim Association, YMMA, they called for the support of Al-Haraka Al-Wataniya, meaning like the national movement, right? And that was a national movement centered around anti-colonial and anti-Zionist resistance. And so I think he definitely speaks to a kind of revolutionary nationalism, right? To use the words of Huey Newton, a kind of revolutionary nationalism is so central to the liberation struggles of people in the global South, right? And the ways in which nationalism has historically really been a tool for oppressed people, a way to understand connectedness to one another, right, in these anti-colonial struggles, because there's a nationalism, but I mean, he's also not Palestinian, right? Technically, this is someone who's Syrian. And so he's joining a struggle for national liberation, right? It's not like clear cut as this is some kind of like cultural nationalism, right? And I think it's important to make that distinction, because we could argue that the Palestinian traditional leadership at the time were advocating for a kind of cultural nationalism, right? They were advocating for the recreation of a Palestinian creation of Palestinian wealth and power and so on through like nationalist lines. But what he was advocating for was different, because there was that revolutionary element and there was that connectedness to anti-colonial struggles. He made connections to the struggle in Algeria, right, against the French. And so there is definitely a nationalist element as well as like a regional element, understanding that there's a colonial struggle, an anti-colonial struggle being waged across the region as well.
Well, he recognized colonization for what it was. At this time, too, I think it's important to remember that the Arabs had been allied with the Brits, right, for so long through those years in the tens throughout, earlier too, right? I think it's throughout the early 20th century, the Brits are working hand in hand assiduously to convince Arabs that we're the key to your salvation, bro. Like, you know, but we all know how that movie ended. So I guess in some ways that's, I don't know, what is the relationship to the so-called Arab revolt to end the Palestine struggle? Because at the same time that it's supposed to be, I guess the Balfour Declaration is really the important thing, right? And then that development until the development of 1929 and the breakout of that first, I guess, what is 1929 called in the Palestinian historiography? Does it have a name or anything? Or because it is the watershed moment in his life, nowhere, and a lot of people in the country too, knowing that, look, this is headed towards some kind of confrontation. This is not gonna get any better, this migration.
And that was the dispute over the Wailing Wall, right? Where there were massacres in Jerusalem and El-Khalil and Safad. And those particular conflicts, for lack of a better term, resulted in the hanging of three Palestinian men, right? I think a nurse, a chauffeur, and a laborer, who were then kind of framed as being central to that that clash. And I think, you know, it's interesting that it's framed as like this watershed moment, right? Because I think that was also at the point where, when as I was reading through the history, realizing as soon as we hit 1929, I started to read things more in a timeline sense, because I was almost, as I was reading through the history, kind of counting down to what I understood was, okay, this was a 6 to 7 year time frame between this moment and the Arab revolt, right? And during that time, I think there were these confrontations that were happening all across Palestine that were targeted acts of resistance. And I know there's that one, which I guess we can unpack even more a little bit later, but that the New Year's Eve home bombing it was the Yacoubi family, and it was ultimately tied, and there was this kind of elaborate sort of framing of the Qasimites and his particular one of his cells, and I say cells, I should explain that means one of his resistance units, because he was operating under a pretty unique structure, which was to put together all of these resistance units. So he was working, going to different parts of Palestine, having meetings either in these poor neighborhoods or inside caves, where he was building resistance cells that all, to some extent, operated independently of each other and in secret. And there was a bombing that took place, and it was one of his members was arrested for it, or one of the Qasimites was arrested for it, and kind of tricked into admitting an admission that he later said it wasn't true. He was put under pressure. They told him they had taken his wife, right? And this was the British police. And during this time frame, right, we saw this event being used by these Zionist leaders, Ben Gurion, right, who was already kind of ramping up these calls and saying that this meant that the British needed to crack down on the Palestinian population. And so you see that like very clear cooperation between the Zionists and the British as soon as you know, 1929 onwards, really. In these key moments leading up to the 1933 riots and then eventually the Arab revolts. I think I've missed some key details. I don't know if Ziad, you have.
just a couple of minor things, just to answer also like Sina's question. It's called Thawrat al-Buraq, because it's the Wailing Wall is supposed to be where, you know, Prophet Muhammad, I think he tied his steed, al-Buraq, when he was like ascending to heaven. So I'm just, I'm not sure about the religious details there, but that was like to, one thing also about, you know, using cells as organizing units, and to relate it to this wider context, you had an experience of, he must have experienced this also in Egypt in the late 19th century when he goes, there were also secret organizations, anti-colonial secret organizations. So L'Orwell Wothka wasn't just a journal, which means like the firmest bonds. It was also a kind of underground organization involved in anti-British work, you know, propaganda work, but also more practical, I guess, elements as well. To discuss these events, it's also, as Yara's pointing out, it's the point in time where, you know, the Palestinian masses, if we're talking about the peasantry and the working class, also, they just no longer have any trust in the traditional leadership as well. Because when this stuff is happening, there is, again, you know, a kind of heavy reluctance by this leadership to abandon their mode of politics, which is, okay, we'll keep petitioning the British until something happens. And so it's precisely in this context where Al-Qassam is able to recruit people. And yeah, I actually just wanted to say something briefly about sort of what he was doing on the ground in terms of recruitment. You mentioned the kind of theatrical performances that he had. And I think that's really interesting if you look at these guerrilla movements in general, where in most cases the population is illiterate. So in Palestine in the 1930s, only 11% went to school and, like, you know, went to primary school, not very good school. So again, we don't know if that's even a functional literacy. So using theater to narrate a kind of historical event and to imbue it with contemporary political significance is, you know, it's actually quite fascinating the way this happens. Because some of the Arabic sources as well, they talk about another reenactment which worked in Haifa as well, precisely because it's on the sea. It's sort of where he says, you know, he did this kind of theatrical performance where somebody pretended to be Tariq ibn Ziyad, and Tariq ibn Ziyad was the Muslim leader that led the conquest of the Iberian Peninsula in the early 8th century. And, you know, he has this famous saying, you know, the sea is behind you and the enemy is in front of you. So it's supposed to be a kind of, you know, invoking the decisiveness of the moment. So he applies that in the context of Zionist colonialism and encroachment in Palestine. Yeah, so that was my...
I mean, that makes me think even to... I'm trying to just think if it was Sanagin that makes this distinction. You know, when trying to unpack, like, okay, well, what was his significance, right? Why is this person, why do we see him? Like, I mean, he has been picked up through different waves of Palestinian resistance. And one of the things that comes up is, you know, he was able to, and the words, and it was Sanagin who says, he was able to do what many in Jerusalem in particular of the traditional Palestinian leadership were unwilling to do, which is, you know, he took these landless and dispossessed fallahin peasants, and he pointed directly at British colonialism and at Zionists, and said, "This is the cause. This is what's making what this is what's dispossessing you. This is the cause of your despair, right?" And you know, that sort of speaks to these theatrics that you were talking about, Ziad, like the way in which he was able to do that, which I think was really central. I would also say that, you know, it's interesting doing a reading of like almost a timeline of the organizing. So I know we touched on the question of 1929 and then the 32 New Year's bombing, which then resulted in a pretty big investigation and prosecution that then would have really significant impacts on the Palestinian revolt. And that home bombing in 1932 was called, you know, the first revolutionary experience, Tajriba Thawriya. And in that particular moment, there was still, I think, the peasants were still being kind of brought on this revolutionary journey, right? Where the goal of that particular, like the target in that particular bombing was the Zionists, right? But then once you move into 1933, where you had the 1933 riots that came out of the British police killing 15 Palestinians in Jaffa, all of the energy was directed towards the British. And so by that point, it becomes really clear that there is a that the British mandate is an enemy. And so reading through his organizing, reading through his strategy, the way that he brought, you know, went to these different places, different, oftentimes lower class and landless communities, and radicalized them through this vision of, or this statement of connecting British colonialism and Zionist expansion, and that there were elements of class consciousness that were shifting with all of these pivotal moments, right? And so the class consciousness and the ways in which there was a response in 1929 was really different than the kind of class consciousness that you had in 33, where the British were clearly seen as colonizers. And then, of course, all of that compounds into, I think, a particularly important moment in time, which was the Arab revolt. I will just add one last kind of thing that I thought was really fascinating, just because we haven't touched on this point yet, is... So we talk about his organizing through the YMMA, which obviously involves bringing men into this, young men into this, these cells, revolutionary units. But I also came across this this piece called "Fighting on Two Fronts: Conversations with Palestinian Women" by Soraya Antonius, and she references. So she has it's firsthand interviews, and one of the people she interviews, who is just named Samir, says she wrote this woman reflects that when she was a teenager, Izzeddin al-Qassam came to the schools to mobilize them, and he trained and took a group of schoolgirls and organized them in preparation for the revolt. And so, what you know, she says that they taught her how to use a rifle, but she never really used the rifle. She the schoolgirls were responsible for getting food to the fighters, moving around freely and collecting money to fundraise for weapons. And because they were able to kind of pass through and without any issues per se when going through areas that were heavily policed by the British mandate and Zionist policemen, right? And that sort of made me think a lot about Algeria as I was reflecting on that. And so it was definitely an organizing strategy that I think was reflective of a broader anti-colonial movement at the time.
So should we talk toward the final years of his life, so the last five probably, because those are probably the most consequential from 29 to 35. So the 29 and then 33, what happened? So maybe you might be useful, Ziad, maybe a kind of brief outline of this decade.
Yeah. So Yara already talked about sort of the events of 1929 and the British response. But then in the period after that, you also have an attempt to sort of amplify political agitation by elements of the Palestinian bourgeoisie. Because I think this, like, one interesting thing, if you look at it also, is that there is also a process whereby there is a kind of internal struggle as well between the big landowners, the traditional ayin, and elements of the Palestinian bourgeoisie, who maybe are more willing to engage in a confrontation with the mandate government. So there is also that kind of internal division happening. But also, by the mid 1930s, it's clear that this Palestinian bourgeoisie is still, there are limits on what it can call for. So they can call for protests, even sometimes boycotts, but obviously they will not support an armed struggle. So again, there are limitations there. So by 1935, so 1933, you had basically the whole country was ablaze with protest movements. But there wasn't really armed revolt. You had sort of assassination attempts by specific factions, but most of the country, most Palestinians were reaching a kind of boiling point, and the country was ablaze. And here, one thing to point out is the difference between somebody like Amin al-Husseini, so Mufti al-Aqsa, the Mufti in Jerusalem, and somebody like Izzeddin Qassem. So in 1933, when the whole country is sort of engaged in this in these protests and all of that, Izzeddin Qassem is now very much interested in raising money for arms, because this is sort of where he sees the need to direct one's energy. Whereas you have somebody like Al-Hajj Amin al-Husseini, he's raising money for Al-Aqsa, basically, to do like mosque repairs and stuff. So it's a kind of different, you sort of see these splinters in different modes of politics.
Well, it's the violence question. Yeah, that's it. Yeah, like this is. This is the thing that always returns to, right? Like, how do you stop this, is what they were all asking themselves. And the elite always want to send petitions, and modern day, that's called tweeting and whatever. Right. And that's why they fetishize, like protests and stuff. And then the people who usually get things done are the ones who realize that, like, oh, this is something happening by force, which we then will have to stop by force. But this has to be worked out in the kind of national psyche, I guess.
Right. And so one significant event also, I think, which I think I didn't mention, is the discovery of, well, people had suspicions that Zionists were getting arms into the country. But I think in 1935, I'm sorry, I don't have the date at hand.
Yeah,
right? Yeah, they discovered this, you know, a crate is basically discovered that's labeled
October
as building 16th, supplies.
October 16th, 1935.
Okay, yeah, yeah. And so that becomes really significant because now there is clear evidence that the Zionists are arming. So, you know, someone like Azzeddin Qassem thinks, well, now we must, you know, arm ourselves, obviously, because it's clear what's happening.
Yeah, and he goes into, like, picking up on that point in 1935. This is sort of the moment where he begins to prepare, right, for what he sees is inevitable. It's a revolution is coming, a revolt is coming, and he wants to prepare. And so, you know, as Ziad already mentioned, there was the purchasing of arms, selling personal belongings to buy weapons for the cause, and then the beginning of organizing, and they go into they start to recruit, waiting for this impending revolt, and they go into hiding essentially as they start to prepare, and he at this point is waiting for the spark to ignite, right? And he can't imagine that the spark is actually going to be his martyrdom, because then in 1935 in November, one of his men shoots accidentally, it seems like it was a Jewish policeman, Sergeant Rosenfeld, who kind of finds their gathering, finds where they're hiding, and so one of his men has to shoot the policeman, and you end up with what would be one of the longest manhunts in British colonial history, with Al-Qassam and his group of men essentially immediately fleeing the area and going into hiding, where they would eventually be gunned down in a cave in Yabed, which is near Jenin, in Jenin. And, you know, this is sort of where, I mean, this is where he's killed, but this is also where, a long fight happens between his men and the British. And in it, you know, the newspapers reported and his men reported that he says he instructed them to fight until the last drop of blood, and says that this is a holy war for God and the homeland, and tells them, you know, to die a martyr's death, right? Die like martyrs. And that's where you have that moment where this particular, his legacy results in how we understand as Palestinians modern day martyrdom, right? And this concept of martyrdom that's been with us for the last 90 years. And his death is the spark that ignites the Arab revolts, right? You know, he was organizing, waiting for that ignition, and he becomes that spark. Because what you end up happening, what ends up happening is, immediately the villagers come. They take his body. He's and he has a huge funeral. Estimates of, you know, range from hundreds to 30,000, but I think Some reports say that this was one of the largest political gatherings in British Mandate Palestine. And during his funeral, the Palestinians are absent. They're not there. And you see kind of this immediate effort also by the Zionists and the British to downplay his legacy, right? So the British newspapers call, you know, dismiss the death as a gang of bandits, right? Which was intentional. It was a strategy to try to delegitimize the movement, because they understood clearly that this could have catastrophic impacts for colonial rule. And the Palestinian elite was afraid that this was going to be the beginning of a populist nationalist movement that was not interested in their leadership or their sham of leadership, right? And during this huge funeral, you have the YMMA calling on Palestinians to emulate the martyrs. So almost immediately, that concept of martyrdom is invoked. And an important note about his funeral is that him and his men are draped in three flags, the flag of Saudi Arabia, the flag of Yemen, and the flag of the newly independent Iraq, right? Not because he had any affinity to those countries, but because these were the newly independent nations. So immediately he becomes canonized as this like anti-colonial figure, almost immediately for the Palestinians. With protests and memorials all across, including in Syria, and well outside of Haifa. And essentially, this leads to the Arab Revolt. And it's interesting kind of reading this history and understanding that it wasn't just that his martyrdom inspired the Arab Revolt. It went even beyond that, which is that his men were central to the starting of the Arab Revolt, right? Because he still had all of these men who had been trained, who have had these weapons. And his men played a central role in the Arab Revolt. And the Palestinian leadership in the time leading up to the Arab Revolt were in a panic to try to do what they could to stop it. One of the notes that I think Sanagan makes is that there was there's a disconnect. So during his funeral, they were all absent. But by the time there was his 40-day commemoration, they came and they gave speeches because they understood that, you know, that there was a wave, that a wave of protests was about to happen, and they were either going to get left behind or they had to jump on board. And the British during this time as well immediately understood that they needed to, you know, jump on this moment. And there were warnings that the British, I'm quoting here also from Sanagan, which is that they would lose their influence, that if the Arab leaders were not granted at least some of their requests, that they would lose their influence and possibly, this would an all possibility of pacification by the moderate means would vanish. And so the British also understood immediately that the Arab leaders needed to be propped up even stronger and given some legitimacy, because a wave of violent revolts was about to happen as a result of his martyrdom.
Yeah, and just maybe to follow up briefly on that, I think in connection to sort of the revolt of 1936, one thing that Al-Qassem showed was that political action can be organized and carried out independently of the traditional Palestinian leadership, which is what happens in 1936. So in that sense, it's sort of, you know, his martyrdom makes also a specific kind of politics possible. And I think that's significant in terms of, you know, assessing, okay, because you could say, look, as a military operation, it failed, you know. They were surrounded and killed, you know, outnumbered, of course.
Pretty quickly. Too.
Yeah, quickly. Yeah. Because it was accidental. There wasn't supposed to be engagement at this point in November. They meant to recruit more people.
But if they had, even though,
would it have been any different?
Yeah. Like, so they were outmatched. So. Yeah, like, they were outmatched. Yeah. I mean, sorry to interrupt you, but like something you said at the beginning of one of our first episode about Egypt, which you were saying about the story of 1948 and how the Zionists really had, there was no way that the Zionists couldn't win that one because of the prehistory of that. But maybe there is something embedded in the story of Al-Qassam about why maybe that same failure, like he was doomed to be a failure.
Right. I mean, military failure in that sense. Of course, I agree. I mean, look, and this is sort of, you know, if we connect it to, and Yara, I'm sure, has more to say about this than I do. Look, you know, you can understand it in terms of an underdeveloped society confronting the most, you know, well-developed military machine at that time, very well-developed military policing techniques. You know, the British had, you know, manuals that they were using from sort of the late 19th century, basically gathering and distilling all of their experience in engaging in this kind of colonial policing from India, from Malaysia, all over, right? So yeah, I mean, there is this massive gap. But then the question I think we should raise is it then rational to resist that? And I want to argue that yes, it is. Not because you're going to win in that moment, but you make the possibility of victory. You know, you bring about the possibility of a future victory, because one necessary condition for any kind of successful resistance is that people actually resist.
People believe.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the thing, you know, if you don't believe, if this is, you know, one of Israel's founding myths is that it's, you know, militarily invincible and all of that, right? And so these kinds of operations, they're significant in that respect, I would say. Sorry, that was a bit tangential.
Also, I think I think it's clear the threat that he posed, right? Like, I mean, we see that with the way that he was tried to downplay his significance, right? Dismiss him. And then one story that really stood out to me as I was sifting through this was that 30 something years later, 32 years later, Moshe Dayan, who was at the time, what was his official Israel's defense minister? He had actually been one of the guards at Nahalal at the time of Yaakovi's death, right? And 35 years later, he still thought of Al-Qassam and his men, so much so that in a 1967 meeting with the Israeli prime minister at the time and Yitzhak Rabin, who was the military chief of staff, they asked Dayan what he thought about a planned Israeli assault on Jenin. And Dayan responds and suggests, we have to take Yabad first, because it had history. And in his account, and this is taking from Sanagin, Dayan says, Jacob's son had sold their brother Joseph. It was where Jacob's son had sold their brother Joseph. But more importantly, it was where Al-Qassam had been shot and killed. So, you know, you see this kind of, like, he remained a site of struggle. And shortly after, Israel then went to raid the home of his biggest supporters, the Al-Wasfi family. And because there had been rumors at the time that he had entrusted them with his sword, and his sword had been kind of commemorated, like it had been mentioned in his funeral, and kind of developed this sort of legendary status. And so the Israeli soldiers then went on to raid the home of the Al-Wasfis and took the sword, which to this day, you know, is unaccounted for. Which then brings me to like this last kind of symbolic piece that stood out to me, which was reading about his current gravesite, right? Which remains the site of struggle to today. And so, you know, his gravesite has repeatedly been vandalized by Israelis, because I mean the area that it's in Haifa is you know, an Israeli community. So his grave has been repeatedly vandalized. They even there was a case of a severed pig's head that was placed on his tomb. Arsonists have tried to light up the cemetery, and there was even an attempt at taking his tomb. There was a tunnel that was found at some point, so much so that a group of volunteers who've named themselves the Popular Committee for the Defense of the Cemetery of Al-Qassam was created to advocate for the site's preservation.
He's still inspiring resistance.
When he's
dust.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and it just shows that, like, I mean, just his grave alone is a threat, right? There is this, like, he remains a site of struggle, and his legacy remains a site of struggle. And I think the area where his grave, where his tomb is, there is a Israeli plan for development, and there have been protests around that, and Palestinians of Haifa and beyond have threatened that if the area gets developed, there will be an intifada, you know? And so there's like this like affinity to his legacy, and the Israelis continue to this day to see his legacy as being something that's threatening to them.